House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 9th, 2015. The first item on the agenda, we're going to jump down to House Bill 3168 and call Representative Benz.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3168 comes to this committee from Representative Benz, Olson, and Post. The bill authorizes court to waive previously imposed fines if the offender completes drug treatment as a condition of probation. It also authorizes the court to enter a supplemental judgment modifying court-appointed attorney fees if payment of the fees would interfere with the offender's ability to pay for drug treatment. There is a recent amendment that I have not summarized that works better for the court's accounting practices and says that an offender cannot get money back that they've already paid into the court as a fine. There is no revenue impact. I don't have a fiscal impact yet, and the bill is not ready to move.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Cliff Benz, State Representative of District 60. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. And since I'm going to have to leave in just a few moments and run off to another committee, I want to point out that I have the Cully family here from Baker City who drove over for this purpose. This bill was brought in part because of their circumstance. Their father asked that I bring this bill, and they will be able to explain why. The bill has an amendment, and the amendment is important and will, I hope, take the place of that which you see on page one. The back of the bill would remain the same. Mr. Chair, the purpose of the bill is to allow people who have served their time, returned home, and are trying to receive treatment and get their lives back together, but find that the fines or other costs are so great they can't afford to pay for the very treatment programs they have to go through to get their lives back in order. So this is one of those challenging circumstances where people owe a debt, they realize they owe the debt, but to get back to a point where they can actually go back to work and pay the debt, they need sometimes relief from some of those obligations. So the bill is an attempt to give the judge authority in just probation situations, which the amendment would need to be modified to capture, and to address that challenge. And the folks that are here can further explain it. Okay.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Benz? Thank you, Representative. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you.
You're busy. Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Representative Benz had asked me to come up to be with him. Just to explain by way of the Dash 1 amendment, we had discussions with Representative Benz. He will want to further limit the language there to say during any period of supervision while on probation, the court may, because the court retains jurisdiction while the person's on probation. But if the person goes down to the Department of Corrections, the trial court loses jurisdiction at that time. So just to explain, he just wanted me to explain that.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you. Any questions for Ms. Myers? Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
The Cully family? And you can go in any order, but be sure to identify yourself for the record. Just state your name for this report.
Okay, my name is Georgia Cully. I would like to thank Mr. Chairman for listening to this bill. What I think you need to understand kind of right away is that even though the Cully family went to Mr. Benz and have talked to him for well over a year about the problems that is going on, this bill isn't for us. It is for every single family in the state of Oregon that has a daughter, mother, anybody in their family on probation. And so this bill really will affect tens of thousands of people, not just us. We're just the ones that came oral with it, because this is one of those bills in which what happens many times when these kids get into the judicial system, they come out and they're literally broke. They have lost everything that they have, and then they turn around and they have all of these court costs and fines, and they can't get jobs to pay them on. And what happens is, the state is not fining the felons; they're fining the families, And it's not just them. It's the mothers and the fathers and the aunts and the uncles and the cousins and everybody else who is trying to come up to this with this money to help them get started again. They're not trying to forgive their debts by any way. It's just they're in such a deep hole when they first get out. It's very, very difficult to get out of it. And this bill will help the judicial system make some amends on how it's repaid and when it's repaid, that they can do it at a pace that will work for them and will allow them to get especially the drug and alcohol treatment that is always mandatory, because they can't work and go to classes at the same time. All right? And so that's what this bill is for. It's for just lots and lots of family, and I'm sure you guys can sit there yourself and think about how many people in your family that this bill could affect. So please understand that this is a statewide, not just us up there in Baker County.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, for seeing us today. My name is Lisa Culley. I'm the youngest of a trio that suffers from some addiction and dual diagnosis issues. In 2011, I was convicted of two felony charges for delivery of methamphetamines. With those charges, I have served over 4 years on probation, totaling just less than $10,000 in court fines, fees alone. I have been paying on it for months now. My budgeting as a single mother on TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, I only bring in about $412 a month. With my treatment program and bare minimal UAs, I have a bill of $315 a month, and that is including treatment and probationary supervision fees. And that's just monthly, and I've been on it almost 4 years. So not to assess that, I did lose my license during the term of incarceration. It's stated in under statutes that the fines are imposed and fixed by a court mandated system already. excuse me. So having the court being able to kind of have that leniency to be able, I don't have a lot of money, but I have a lot of heart to give, effort to give. I mean, I can shovel snows, I can talk to other addicts and things like that. I can do that a whole lot better than I can give the state a bunch of money, you know? Those options available to, I know that there would be a lot more community resources involved that me and many of my friends would be more than willing to do to pay back society in ways that we are equipped to do instead of the monetary programs. When I was trying to get my license back, so many of the fines were put into a private collection agency, and due to the where they can actually charge a 17% interest rate also, the state already has an issue where there's a $200 deposit and you pay, you can get your license back, but a felon with no license has almost absolutely no chance of getting a job, especially in a town of 9,000 people where I come from. So with that, we had my mother over here, this dear, beautiful woman that has survived so much. Forked out $2,000 out of her own for me to get my license back, to just have that extra little edge so I could pay these fines and pay these fees and these regulations that have been hindering, honestly, us since 2011. So there are, there's a lot of other, what's the word I want to use? There's a lot of other options that could be so much more productive for our communities, you know, listening to our successes, our hardships, things like that, where we really can give back, because the money's just not there. McDonald's, Fred Meyer's, Burger King, those places do not hire felons. They do not. And, as I'm coming up on a 5-year mark, and I have been out of work for 8 solid months, and I literally fill out between 6 and 10 applications or drop off resumes in a week. And I have not been able to find a job, and it is due to my criminal history. So where my fines come from? My monthly fine comes from my dear, beautiful, wonderful mother who is endeared so much. So thank you very much. I know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking the time to hear this case. My name is Ryan Cully. I am an addict, and I'm the middle child. There's a lot of things I would like to see. For one, when you take the power away from the judge, sorry guys, I'm a little bit nervous, but take the power away from the judge, you know, who generally in a little town like ours, generally these repeat drug offenders and stuff, you know, they know each other, you know, and to be honest, I feel like the judge has a better idea of what really is needed for that individual to become successful. And I do believe that, I think if you can complete a treatment, and I don't know, you know, I don't know if that's an outpatient or I don't know if that's an inpatient, I don't know who would decide that, but if you were able to complete a treatment program, I think there should be some type of reward, a reduction on your total amount that you owe, or, you know, it'd be nice to see some of it go away. Like my sister was saying, you're punishing my family for what I've done. And it's, you know, we spent, mom's got over $500 just in this trip, so we can come talk to you guys. And I mean, just like she yelled, my sister's put, you know, I lost my license when I was incarcerated for failure to pay fines because I was incarcerated. And, you know, just, I mean, getting back into life and being part of society again, where, you know, you're actually part of the community and not a part of the problem. It's hard right at first when addiction's hard. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I think that, I guess basically what it comes down to is I think the judge should have more choice and not be mandated on a lot of the costs that he have to do. Like my sister was saying, I'm on supervised parole. I am ongoing outpatient treatment. I have child support payments. I don't have a child with me, so I don't qualify for TANF, you know, for even that, you know. I mean, I literally depend on my parents for absolutely everything. And it's, I love you. But, that's all I got, I guess. Thanks,
guys. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming down and telling your story, and especially appreciate you taking that long, long trip to get over here to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
As you heard, we don't have the amendments ready to move today, so we won't be able to move the bill today. But thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3168. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3437.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3437 is a committee bill. It authorizes certificates of good standing for certain offenders. And it creates a process to obtain these certificates of good standing. I don't have an amendment yet. I believe there is an amendment coming that will simplify significantly the process for which one can obtain a certificate of good standing. We don't have the fiscal impact back yet, so it's not ready to move.
Okay, thank you. Kimberly Mansfield, Wendy Beavis, and Todd London.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. My name's Kimberly Mansfield, and I coordinate the legal clinic at the Dominguez Reentry Resource Center here in Salem. The purpose of this bill, the Certificate of Good Standing, is to reduce the barriers to employment, which is proved to reduce recidivism. Hence the title, or the moniker at least, A Working Oregon is a Safer Oregon. At the legal clinic, a quarter to a third of our clients have expungement inquiries. And trust you me, expungement is not the answer. I repeatedly tell them, whether they're ineligible or eligible, don't get too excited, don't get too bummed out. There is no true expungement. And we can thank technology for that. It's fine. You don't have to tick the box on an application. But the second that employer pulls a $19 background check, it comes up. So the seed of inconsistency is planted there. And these are private companies. They're under no obligation to update their records. They're hard to find. They're slippery. They change names. They offshore, much like the mugshot type companies. So individuals are stuck with this. Their certificate of good standing would reduce some of the vulnerabilities of the opportunity holders. The importance of this is the volume involved. 93% of inmates are going to be released. And they are going to be our neighbors, our coworkers, patrons, parents of children who are classmates of our children. This has a very, very broad reach. The bill is fresh. It's different. There aren't states doing this right now. I mean, for Oregon, it could be akin to something like our beach bill or our bottle bill. The purpose is to put Oregon to work, and we have a population that can fill that. Every year, about 550 people are released to Marion County alone. In 2010, the statewide number was about 400 inmates a month. So a working Oregon is a safer Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3437.
You need to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Wendy Beavis, and I'm with the Medical Foundation's Moms Plus program. I work as a mentor. And so I'm here today because I struggled with addiction for 18 years of my life. And then one day I finally had my daughter and decided to get clean and change my life. So because of my addiction, I ended up with two felony drug convictions and two misdemeanors. So once I started trying to find work, I realized that because of my criminal history, it was going to be really hard to get a good job. So I decided to go to school. So I went to Chemeketa for 2 years and got my Associate of Arts Occupational Transfer degree. And then I went on to Portland State University, where I got a Bachelor's in Social Sciences. And I graduated magna cum laude with a 3.89 while raising three kids and a husband. So that was a lot of work, but I got through it. So then I was really excited to go out and get a job. Mind you, I acquired $56,000 in debt of financial aid loans. But I thought it would be okay because I could go out and get a great job now because I had a degree. So I started looking for work and started getting discouraged because every time you go to the job application, it says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And of course, I have to say yes. So I felt like all the employers are going to look at is my felony. They're not going to look at my degree. They're not going to look at the good things I had done. So luckily, I got a job at the Medica Foundation. Shaney Starr wanted to give me a chance, and I work with single moms in recovery. So part of that job is actually having the life experiences that I had. So I was really fortunate in that. And so currently, I'm working with single moms in recovery. Most of them are on they either get financial aid or they're on welfare. And they want to be self-sufficient, and they want to get jobs. But like me, there's a lot of barriers, especially with a criminal background. So that's why I am supportive of this bill. I think having the Certificate of Good Standing would help those moms. It would have helped me when I was looking for work, and I think it'll make a big difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Todd London, and I'm the proud owner of a local Salem business, ABC Window Cleaners. It's been around for 80 years. I work with the Marion County Reentry Initiative to try to help and put people who are coming out of incarceration to work. Some are very successful and some aren't. One of the successes is my general manager. He's now been with me for 6 years. He's come from living under a bridge with an addiction to meth, to getting his family back, to getting a house, to getting cars, and he's been with me for 6 years, and he's an amazing individual, and he was featured in a video by the Marion County Reentry where I'm a volunteer. I'm working hard to get other businesses to understand what it's like and how to get people from incarceration to work. I'm completely in support of House Bill 3437, as it'll provide a better pathway to employment through employers that are sitting on the edge. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you for being an employer that, that helps out like that, because we do know it makes a huge difference if people are able to.
Thank you.
And thank you for your story, too.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
For your hard work. Any further? Derek Harkler, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm the senior policy advisor for the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I've been working on reentry since at least 2009. We did some of it when I was district attorney, but here in this building, trying to get help for offenders who are successful on their probation or they're coming out of prison. This concept, certificate of good standing, is a good one. Okay, it will reduce those barriers a little bit. I don't want to overstate it in what I think about that. The concept itself is good. The bill needs work. It's points from one section to another. For example, Section 2 says a person who has been convicted of a felony or a Class A misdemeanor. Doesn't say whether it could be 1, 2, or 10, or you could do it when you're 18, do a burglary, make it through the system successfully, get your certificate by the time you're 23, and then commit another crime when you're 25, do your time or whatever it happens to be, and then at 30 get another certificate. So there needs to be some work in that area. Then later in the bill on page 229, it says the petitioner meets the criminal eligibility requirements described in subsection 2. That's the one I just talked about, where there are no criminal eligibility requirements other than it says a felony or a Class A misdemeanor. So it needs some work is the point. Now, as I understand it, there's an amendment coming, and that may clarify this. There's also stuff about reentry. If there is a reentry court steering committee, if not, it goes to the Board of County Commissioners, then it goes to the circuit court. That's very clumsy. It's very time consuming. You're not going to like the fiscal on this bill, I don't think. If I have to write a fiscal on this with the what the DA has to do here, it's going to put a lot of money into it, and it needs to be streamlined. So I'm just going to stop there. Let's see the Dash 1 amendments or whatever, and maybe it'll clean it all up, and it'll be a good thing to do.
Thank you. Any questions? Our Representative Krieger, just a second. Doug?
Oh,
Representative Krieger.
I couldn't let you get away, Doug. I appreciate that you're willing to take a look at this, because of anything I've learned in the 15 years I've been here, locking them up and then releasing them and expect them to be successful isn't going to work. And so, as we've talked about under 3194 and others, having an opportunity to have an education, housing, job, all these type of things is going to cause recidivism to go down. And anything that any of us can do, including the DAs, to work towards that and understand with new technology what that means, I think we'll make ground, have good, you know, progress, and maybe someday we won't have as many people coming into the system, and recidivism will be down. Maybe we can balance those numbers that we have in our prison system.
Chair Barker, that sounded like something I should listen to. I agree.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3437. We have the bill about modifying modifies the crime of displaying obscene materials. We're waiting for Representative Olson to get here. He's tied up right now, so we're going to move on to one other bill first. Open a public hearing, House Bill 2907.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2907 is a committee bill. The bill modifies existing law and creates a statutory definition of recidivism for youth offenders. Under the proposed bill, a youth recidivates if the youth has any juvenile court referral or arrest within 3 years of either a previous juvenile court referral or being released from custody. In addition, a youth recidivates if they have any arrest as an adult that occurs within 3 years of the juvenile court referral. We don't have any fiscal impacts back on this bill yet.
Okay, thank you. Chuck French and John Foote, please.
Good afternoon. Good. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Foote. I'm the Clackamas County DA, and with me is Chuck French, who's a retired Multnomah County DA and works part-time in our office. It's a pleasure to talk to you today. We've been looking at some of the stuff that's been submitted to you and trying to figure out what it all means. But I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the idea behind this bill. As you remember, last year in 3194, and I was one of the people involved in doing it, we revised the definition for adult recidivism to make it more accurate and complete. The legislature passed that. It's now the law. And it is in that same spirit that we have proposed this particular definition as well. We think it's fairly consistent with the adult definition, and it is offered in the spirit of making things better, because we don't think we can really make things better until we really have a conclusive way of defining what we're talking about. So it's really very simple. It uses the same triggering offenses as before. We did add arrest versus referral. We're flexible on that. We think arrest is more inclusive, but we'd be willing to go back to referral, which is what's used now. Specifically, I'd like to refer you to lines 20 through 24 of the first page, section 2, paragraph 1 of 420A010. There was a request for a racial disparity study of this bill, which is the first time I've seen that used. And in those conversations with the Criminal Justice Commission, which we thought were quite productive, Mike Schmidt and his folks came up and talked to us. They discussed with us the problems this section, removal of this section, caused for the Oregon Youth Authority and the way they amassed statistics. To be quite frank, there was nothing surreptitious about removing it. We just thought it would make it simpler. So we have agreed that it could be added back. Doesn't really make any difference. If it provides more flexibility to the Oregon Youth Authority to do their work, we're perfectly fine with that. So I wanted to reassure you about that. If you noticed on our written testimony, that's in fact included in our written testimony, that we're comfortable with that. What we have proposed is consistent with the national standards on how recidivism is defined. The fundamental problem with the current definition, and there are two in Oregon. We didn't know this when we started. There are two definitions of juvenile recidivism, one for the Oregon Youth Authority, one for the juvenile departments, which when we found it, we didn't really understand why that was so. We understand that the Oregon Youth Authority is now doing work to change theirs to more closely track the adult. We didn't know that either until we talked to them. So, but the fundamental principle is to increase the tracking period, because you just simply, 1 year is, there's no other state in the union that uses 1 year. So 3 years is the standard time. The federal government under the Bureau of Justice Statistics now tracks 5 years. We're not proposing that. So that's really the guts of it. We also looked at the idea that if something happens within the 3 years after they turn 18, it shouldn't be not counted. So that's the principle behind that. It's really quite a simple concept, be glad to take any questions. Mr. French wants to talk a little bit about the study that we've provided to you from the CJCA on this very subject. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Chuck French. As Mr. Foote said, I worked for many years for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I now work a few hours every month for Mr. Foote on matters such as this. As Mr. Foote also said, 2 years ago in the legislature changed the adult definition of recidivism to change it to a three-year period of time to track arrests. And that is something that I understand the Oregon Youth Authority is now working on with their statistics to conform their statistics in a manner that would fit in with the adult stats on recidivism. For the last at least 6 years, there's been an ongoing movement in this nation to standardize juvenile justice recidivism statistics so one state can compare its performance against another state. Currently, that's not possible, and especially not in Oregon, because Oregon has a standard, as was referred to, that exists nowhere else, at least for the juvenile departments at the county level, that exists nowhere else in the nation. And so we are unable to compare our statistics on recidivism to the statistics that exist in other states. The Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators, and I think you've been provided with a copy of this report, the vice president of that organization is the current director of the Oregon Youth Authority, in 2009 produced this paper. It's a white paper that defines what they believe standardized national statistics on recidivism should look like. In 2010, the Oregon Youth Authority did an analysis of the recidivism statistics used in our state, and they concluded that not a single one met the standards of the Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators. And so what we did when we tried to put this bill together, 2907, is to establish certain standards in laws that would meet the standardized definition by the Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators in the paper you have there. And so that essentially is what this has done within the limits that are provided by our data systems, which I might add are very good. I think in our review of this for the last year, it would appear that Oregon has the best data collection system for juveniles in the country, if not the best, tied for the best in the country. And so we have access to an enormous amount of data that will provide, that should be able to provide us with information on recidivism by juveniles. And so what we simply did was attempt to write into this bill standards that could, using that system that could be, and the system that we have for adults, that could be used to track recidivism and make comparisons from one state to the next. So essentially, open to questions about what, you know, what issues there may be with our standards, but we have attempted to at least meet the standards required or supposedly required by the CJCA. I might add, when you compare the standards we're requesting in this bill, which include arrests, which include tracking into the adult system, which currently doesn't happen, and include new commitments and referrals. When you take a look at that and compare it to what we have now, essentially what we have now for the county level juvenile departments are a statistic which takes a referral from the police and tracks it for 12 months, unless the 12 months goes into the time where the child turns into an adult. So essentially you have a maximum of 12 months and could be a minimum of one day if the child is referred at the end of his 17th year and then turns an adult. It doesn't matter what he does. Will never be considered recidivist. And again, none of these meet the standards that are suggested by the CJCA. So any questions? I'm open to answering any of those questions. I would just have one remark about some of the testimony and objections that I've seen about this, and that is the objections by which I think are in written testimony by Youth Rights and Justice. Their opposition to this apparently is based on the idea, or all of their opposition are based on addition of statistics of recidivism, which for a number of reasons they conclude we should maintain the current definition because they have a number of objections to those. Each one of those objections actually apply to the current definition of recidivism. So I would suggest we take a look. If those are valid objections, the current definition we're using has all the same purported flaws that that are raised there. So anyway, I'm available, as is Mr. Foote, for any questions about this. We hope that Oregon can think about adopting a standard that other states use and that will allow us to compare our performance with other states, because currently we can't do that.
Any questions?
Chair Barker, could I add one more?
Sure.
Just members of the committee. I noticed there was also some comment about discussions going on now between OIA and the criminal justice and the juvenile directors about changing the standard. First of all, I want to tell you those discussions were not going on before we made this proposal. And there is nothing that binds the juvenile departments to change their definition if you don't do anything. So by having a standard statewide, they can still have their standard locally, but they'd also be measured by the state measure. So it's very similar to the adult system where they still, some juvenile, I think many community corrections offices still track the 3-year felony conviction on top of the new definition. So there's nothing that we're proposing that says they can't still track for a year if they want. So, thank you.
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's to either of you. I'm looking on page 30 of the report where the CJCA report, where arrest is defined as an arrest for any offense that would be a crime for an adult. That's not, as far as I can tell, the definition of arrest in the bill.
Give us just a sec, if you would.
Let's see the bill.
It's 30 of 42.
Right. Where's the rest defined in the bill? Where are you looking that up? Okay. Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, members of the committee, I'm not sure where arrest is defined in the bill. Can you help me?
It just says...
on page 30?
No, in the bill.
Okay.
I don't think it's defined.
It's any arrest that occurs within 3 years after the youth. That's on line 26.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or on line 28, any referral to juvenile court or arrest.
Right.
So it seems to me if you're arrested, no matter what, for or what the result is, it would count under this under the bill's definition, but not under the report's definition.
Representative Barker, Representative Williamson, members of the committee.
I'm just trying to.
I think that the fact that it's the arrest is not defined in the bill means that it's defined by Oregon statute. We didn't try to create a new definition, and I think an arrest inherently is consistent with the definition on page 30.
And if you wanted to, for things that aren't necessarily a crime as an adult.
Don't think so. I don't think that's true. I don't think you can arrest anyone except for a crime. But if the committee wanted to change, to add a definition in 2907 to make it explicit in this bill, that we would be fine with that. We think it's that definition on page 30 is consistent with the definition of arrest in Oregon, because arrest implies a crime. Representative Barker and Representative Krieger have been police officers.
An allegation of a crime. But this has a right. This has a further definition of a crime as an adult. And I just want to make sure I'm understanding what we're including in the list that would constitute recidivism. Sure. No, counsel, do you know if there's a definition in Oregon for arrest? Sorry to put you on the spot.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, arrest is defined as when anyone by law enforcement or a citizen, I guess a citizen can do an arrest, loses their liberty interest. It could be for a crime, a criminal allegation. It could be for a violation of supervision allegation. It could be for a warrant from this state or another state. There's a host of reasons why folks could be arrested related to a criminal allegation or just some other reason where their presence is commanded by this state or another state.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, thank you for that clarification. I see now your point. and we would be fine in making that, narrowing the definition in this bill to make sure that this is what we mean. We had to do this in the adult system as well. We just simply didn't catch it. We have no interest in tracking probation violations or those sorts of things. We had to sort of call that out in the adult system too. So with a friendly amendment by the committee, we'd be fine with that, because that was our intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Troy Lynn, Amanda Dalton, and Christine Kirk.
Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Christine Kirk, and I'm the Government Relations and Public Policy Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. OIA has historically followed the Department of Corrections definition of recidivism. So when the discussions occurred in House Bill 3194 to adjust the definition, OIA kind of got a sense that probably we would be asked at some point in time to look at different data for our definition of recidivism. I want to make sure it's clear that because we generally follow the adult system and the definition, it does not mean that the adult and juvenile systems are completely comparable, nor does it mean that they should be compared. It's just simply how it's been done historically. Our current definition for the state of Oregon is a three-year felony conviction. The juvenile departments at the county level use a one-year criminal referral. We've been looking at the data to develop a mirror definition since the fall of 2014. The official request came to us to do this through the governor's office to develop a measurement for the governor's 10-year plan. I should state that we, in this case, is multifaceted. OIA plays this role, as I mentioned, in terms of working with the Department of Corrections, but we also play a role in working with the rest of the juvenile system. The rest of the system is the part that actually deals with the majority of youth who enter the system and are served. So what happens in what we do impacts the rest of the system. And so we immediately embarked on conversations that were part of our JAGIS Data and Evaluation Committee, and that committee is made up of county staff and OIA staff. We also embarked on discussions with the Department of Corrections and the Criminal Justice Advisory Committee to determine what can we collect and how would we do that. I'd like to recognize that the chair of the JAGIS Data and Evaluation Committee, I'm sorry, not the chair, but the staff for the JAGIS Data and Evaluation Committee is Sherry Lingelbach from the Oregon Youth Authority. She currently serves on the CJCA Recidivism Committee. It's the committee that's looking at that white paper to actually take that white paper from concepts of which they are not adopted standards for which all states should use, but figure out what definitions should all states use so that we can compare state to state. Currently, there isn't the mechanism to compare state to state, and so she is working actively on that, and this is a robust national and local conversation that we're tapping into. I want to state that there's a lot of interest and agreement and with some of the concepts that Mr. Foote put forth. We would love to be able to track data past when someone leaves the juvenile system into the adult system. As mentioned, for OIA and the state, we currently do track 3 years into the adult system for convictions. We also would love to be able to add misdemeanors and look more globally at what happens to the people that we serve. The felony look is one slice, and there are other slices that we would like to consider. The issues that we have are in connecting a very robust data system, and I appreciate the mention by Mr. French that it is probably the best in the nation, and I would have to agree that we have the ability to look at our entire juvenile system in one data set and one data place, and it's a wonderful asset. The difficulty that we're having in looking at how to combine into the JAGIS data system to the adult is that there are many systems on the adult side that capture the information from arrest to conviction to incarceration. And we not only have to take and figure out where's all the data we want, what system is it in, we have to figure out how to plug that into and tie it into JAGIS and translate that data from the adult system decision points to the juvenile system decision points. That is a very large task. And unfortunately, there's a lot that can be lost in that connection to help us understand what decisions are we having that actually has an impact. In our work to work with the Department of Corrections and CJC, we have been developing a data cohort. And at first, this data cohort, and you may have heard this already in terms of what they're doing on the adult side, is actually to look at what population can we track? Where do we have the data? This is slightly different than how do we meet the 3194 definition, because all of that data isn't currently available. In particular, in the misdemeanor area, we're beginning to start to connect to all of the misdemeanor data, but do not yet have it available. One of the primary limitations that we have on the juvenile side in doing this that does not exist on the adult side is there is a significant difference between a criminal referral and an arrest. Currently, the juvenile departments use the criminal referral as their standard for measurement. We did a slice of data and said, okay, well, let's look at the arrest data. And what's being used for arrest data is LEDS fingerprint data. That in and of itself is actually different than the arrest data. And that data counts when someone's fingerprinted. They may be fingerprinted multiple times on the same arrest or charge. So there's duplicates within that data. But knowing that, we still took the LEDS data that's being used as the arrest proxy, and we compared it to the criminal referrals. And what we found is that over 80% of the criminal referrals are not included in the LEDS data. So if we continue to use what is the largest net, which is the criminal referral data on the juvenile side, and then we go to arrest or what's available for arrest data on the adult side, we'll see an 80% drop occur in criminal activity or arrest at the point at which someone turns 18. That's a significant change. One would like to say maybe that all of a sudden people's behavior is different, but it's really just because of the data. Now, if we take and say, all right, well, we want to use the same decision point from juvenile to adult, which would make sense, so we don't have that 80% drop, it means the juvenile departments are not reviewing or seeing 80% of the clients that they served any longer, and we're cutting short the data that they're able to use or we're able to use in this robust data system. Regardless of what happens here today, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Department of Corrections, Criminal Justice Commission, and the counties will continue to have discussions, because I think we do all have similar goals, and we do want to be able to reach the standards that are being developed nationally, look over time, many years into time. 3 years may not be enough. Maybe we want to look further. The other thing is that we're a little bit greedy. We want it in real time. We want to be able to connect it to JASIS so we can cut it and splice it and do it in every which way we want. And so we will continue to do that work. I just wanted to let you know that there are some complications in bridging the juvenile system to the adult system. We hope to overcome those, but it will take some time for us to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton here on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice, also to oppose House Bill 2907 as proposed and the proposed changes to Oregon's recidivism definition for juveniles. We believe strongly that this data would be skewed by the disproportionate police contact and arrest of minority youth who are not subsequently found to have committed an offense by a juvenile or criminal court. And if adopted, we offer the following examples of what would count towards the state's reoffense rates. For example, a youth who has never been adjudicated of a delinquent offense, a youth who has had two arrests or referrals to juvenile court would be counted as reoffending without ever being found to have committed an offense by the juvenile court. A youth who has been adjudicated one time but never adjudicated of a new offense or even a probation violation would be counted if they simply had a subsequent arrest or juvenile court referral that was never adjudicated. And finally, a youth who was prosecuted and found not guilty would be counted in recidivism statistics if they had any previous or subsequent arrest or referrals to juvenile courts. These scenarios highlight the potential for real distortion in official recidivism statistics. And as you have heard already, arrest data does not tell the whole story. We urge your opposition to this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Tori Lynn. I'm a juvenile department director in Linn County. I'm also the president-elect for the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, representing all 36 counties in our state. OJDDA opposes House Bill 2907 in its current form. We don't believe it provides a meaningful measure of youth success nor an accurate measure of the performance of the juvenile system. Provided written testimony that's been provided here today on behalf of the Directors Association, so I'm not going to go into great detail on what that testimony says. But in essence, arrested data does not provide a full measure of the success of a youth in our community. Arrest data has more to do with policing tactics, and policies, which can be affected by many different things, specifically funding or, you know, policing certain hot spots, will provide more arrests. Looking only at arrests further institutionalizes racial bias already present in our system. Efforts are currently underway and have been underway for several years at the state and county level to address and eliminate racial bias within our system. Oregon juvenile directors are currently working closely and collaboratively with the Oregon Youth Authority to determine the most compelling and accurate measures of recidivism for our system. The Oregon juvenile justice system is viewed as a leader in the nation for the collection and use of data in decision making. The definition of recidivism needs to be expanded to include many more things than arrest data to accurately measure the success or failure of a youth in our system. You know, as you look at other things like, did a youth attain education? Have they gotten job experience or been able to get jobs? There's other things that we believe should be looked at rather than solely an arrest record. So we would encourage continued conversations around this topic. I guess the Directors Association is not opposed to looking at that definition that's currently underway, but we believe that needs to be a little bit bigger picture than what's currently being proposed by this bill. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much, panel, for your testimony. We appreciate it. Thank you. Shannon White, Elizabeth Kushwa, and Mike Schmidt. And I certainly don't want to cut you short, but we have a couple more minutes today, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide advocacy organization that promotes best practices and public safety policy for both victims of crime and people convicted of crime. We're here today in opposition to House Bill 2907, and I think for a couple of core reasons, the first of which many of you know, we don't think that adult correctional policy and juvenile policy should necessarily be in alignment. We know that youth are different than adults, and in general, we need to think about outcomes and accountability for them in different ways. So we were displeased to see, although it sounds like Mr. Foote is willing to put language back in the bill, that specifically says that this definition must be designed to address outcomes including but not limited to community safety and rehabilitation. We believe those are core values that should be considered when we're doing anything to juvenile justice policy. I think also, as others have mentioned, arrests are often not a good source for data on how people are doing in the system. I think particularly due to, as was said, either place-based or hotspot policing, we often see disproportionality for black and brown youth when it comes to arrests, and that this redefinition without taking some of that into account could look like a very disturbing spike in crime for black and brown youth when actually that would be more based on policies related to arrests. I think some facts that are worth noting is that in 2012, the arrest rate for black youth was double that for white youth, that 70% of school-based arrests were for black or Latino youth, and that black youth are three times more likely to be arrested for minor offenses. So I think we need to consider, particularly in this moment where we're having such a robust conversation about race in the justice system, the impact that this would have on that conversation. And finally, I would just say that I think when we're looking for ways of looking at our system, we want to have as much due process as possible at our data points, and that arrest is not a place where we have as much due process and therefore as much accurate data as we could about who's recidivating in our communities. So we oppose this bill and urge you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I am the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon, where we strive to advocate for policies and programs that strengthen families and help keep kids healthy and safe. And in looking at children, we do tend to prioritize the most vulnerable children. I was going to say that our concerns about this bill were twofold, but it appears that Mr. Foote has addressed one of our concerns, which is that rehabilitation of youth would not have been prioritized under the bill in its current language. That language would have been removed. From the second is that this really will disproportionately affect children of color. From a very young age, children of color face disproportionate discipline. For example, from kindergarten through fifth grade, Native American youth are 1.5 times as likely to be suspended or expelled from school, and African American youth are more than twice as likely to be suspended or expelled. Because 2907 does include arrests, it will increase the number of youth of color who will be defined as recidivists, and there's enough disparity already in Oregon's current juvenile justice system. While there have been fewer youth referred to the system, juvenile system overall, the disparity of the referrals by race are significant. Over 2.5 times for African American children over white children, and nearly twice as many for Native American children over white children. So those would be our concerns, and we thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here today to both give you just a little bit of background on what the CJC has done with recidivism definition in House Bill 3194. We've gone through and are currently going through the process of following that definition, which includes arrests, convictions, and incarceration. So when we looked at this bill, you know, it seems that there's a lot of parts of this bill that are kind of at least attempting to mirror what was done in House Bill 3194. I think Christine Kirk did a good job of outlining some of the information challenges for the committee that we face. But we do believe that a lot of those challenges can be overcome as we continue to get better and develop our information systems around the state. So the CJC is not, we're neutral on this specific bill, but the information can be gotten. As I read this, I've noticed that a lot of people have been discussing the arrests. It does look like that new adjudications and returns to close custody are part of this. That seems very similar to what we're doing in the adult system, where we're talking about convictions and incarceration. So I think we could get the data, but there are data challenges. Misdemeanors is one of those challenges that Christine Kirk pointed out. There are others, but the concept does seem to be similar to what we've done in the adult system, with a lot of the caveats that have already been noted. The Criminal Justice Commission also prepared a racial and ethnic impact statement on this legislation. At that point, when we reviewed this bill as it is, we found it to be indeterminate, because we, working with OIA and working with juvenile directors and their input, there were concerns raised about how this would change risk tools that are used if they had to use this definition. So I think there is a way to address that in this bill so that OIA would not have to alter the risk tools that they use, so we can make sure that they can continue using the same ones that they're using.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2907. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3365. Open a public hearing on 3365. Representative Olson, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3365 comes to this committee from Representatives Olson, Taylor, Springer, and many other sponsors as well. The bill modifies and renames the crime of displaying obscene materials to minors. It adds certain sex toys to the list of prohibited items for minors. There is no revenue impact, and we have no fiscal impact on the bill.
Mr. Chair, my name is Andy Olson, and state representative from the Albany area, and thank you for this opportunity, committee members, and Mr. Chair. I have with me here on far side Michael Slauson from the Attorney General's office to kind of share a little bit about the constitutionality of this bill that we're looking at. And then also I have the mom, Teresa Lee Ferguson, who initially started this issue and shared her concern. But several months ago, there was an incident that occurred in a novelty store. It happened to be Spencer's in the Lloyd Center. And what had happened is that there, Teresa had a one of her kids go inside, and she was a little bit concerned. She's going to share this with you here as we move forward. But there was a number of things that caused some serious grief to her that she would rather it had protection to occur for her child, and was seriously surprised with what she saw was inside the store. As a result of that incident, Carla Costano from KOIN-TV contacted me, came down and visited with me and my office, and showed me what I would like to take a few minutes and show you part of what I had the opportunity to see, but also it kind of gives you a really good detail picture of really what I had the opportunity to see, as they had gone inside with a hidden camera and took photos of what was happening inside the novelty store. So with that, I'm just going to stop right there, and then I'll kind of fill in some more blanks with you. But I really want you to kind of pay attention to this next 6 minutes, and then I will explain the bill to you. Let's proceed.
Now to a Coin 6 News investigation. What if we told you that inside a popular store in many Oregon malls, sex toys and bondage gear were being sold in plain sight to kids, teenagers, families? Our investigative team found this happening all over Oregon.
And the kicker here, it's perfectly legal. Coin 6 investigator Carla Castaño shows us what she uncovered.
Jeff and Ann, we're talking about Spencer's Gifts. We spent the last few months investigating. We went into three stores with undercover cameras. We found all sorts of adult sex toys being sold in plain sight. Parents I talked with are outraged. And when we showed lawmakers what we found, they told me they want things to change. Parents I talked with are outraged. And when we showed lawmakers what we found, they told me they want things to change.
Beer bongs and flasks, an image of a woman's bare rear end. Phallic pins, porn director hat, an image of a woman's bare rear end. Phallic pins, porn director hats, blow-up dolls, small to big to ethnic and elderly. All gag gifts sold at Spencer's Gifts in Lloyd Center. The store is known for selling things like this, but now it's gone much further. These are rows and rows of sex toys. So risque, we've had to blur everything on this wall, and no walls to separate the children from adults.
When parents drop off their kids at the mall, do you think that they have any idea that they're going to be seeing this kind of stuff?
No, I would never. I didn't even know that it was they were doing it. I mean, I haven't been in Spencer's. It's not one of the stores I shop in, but I would never know that that's what they started providing.
I checked, and it's not just the Spencer's at Lloyd Center. The Spencer's at Washington Square Mall had plenty of bright-colored sex toys. We also found a huge assortment of the adult items for sale at the Clackamas Town Center Spencer's. I found there are six Spencer's Gifts carrying the products in Oregon, all at malls. I asked the clerk at the Spencer's in Clackamas if there were any age requirements for selling the sex toys to kids. She told me no. That didn't sit well with parents I spoke with.
They say it's up to the clerk's discretion on who they sell this to, but they try not to
judge. How can they judge? How can an 18-year-old judge how old somebody is?
They say that they don't have to ask for ID, but they try not to sell the young teens.
Wrong. Shouldn't be allowed.
I checked in with adult stores in the area. They have signs posted on their doors saying you need to be 18 years old to enter, and they require photo ID. I contacted Spencer's Gifts LLC Vice President and General Counsel Kevin Mahoney out of New Jersey and asked him to explain why Spencer's was selling sex toys in our area malls.
Here in Oregon, most of the other stores that carry bondage gear and a lot of the other sex toys, they have to be 18.
Because those stores carry pornographic or obscene material and therefore are restricted by law.
But within the Oregon law, Spencer's has several shades of gray to work with. While the statute displaying obscene materials to minors applies to businesses showing any picture or photo that depicts nudity, sexual conduct, sexual excitement, or sadomasochistic abuse, I checked and nowhere in the law are sexual devices listed. So what is obscene material exactly? A colorful mini rope sampler with pictures showing a woman tied up and gagged with the rope? Or psych ward wrist constraints? What about personal massagers that glow in the dark or that flash off and on and in panther print too? Right next to the schoolgirl skirts, moms tell me an obvious appeal to young people.
I think it's really inappropriate.
I took our video to the state capitol to Representative Andy Olson. He has worked on stiffening Oregon's law on sexually explicit materials in the past. He was astounded by what I showed him.
There's a door swing. There's a restraint system.
Dozens of items, all available for purchase by teens, and it's perfectly legal in Oregon.
I have no idea what that is.
Hot love.
Representative Olson was so overwhelmed, he stopped to take notes and read through the law on displaying obscene materials to minors. Not once, but twice. He even had Deputy Legislative Counsel Jessica Minifee double check, and indeed, the sales appear to be legal.
Do you think that the Oregon law currently goes far enough as far as protecting kids from these kind of items?
The way I read the law, no, I don't think so.
The packaging for the sex toys shows silhouettes of women's bodies. There's a poster with these two lovers naked, but blocked out in all the right places.
The idea is, you know, it has sexual conduct, and it depicts nudity. It has sexual excitement.
Representative Olson believes Spencer's has figured out a way to stride pretty close to the legal line. Now, after what I found, he plans to expand Oregon Revised Statute 167080.
Do you think you can get support on both sides of the aisle?
Oh, absolutely. I do believe that you'll see some major support with this. If I were to take that same video that you just showed us, with the other 89 legislators in this building, I think you would see some serious concern.
He tells me he will be proposing a new bill this upcoming session to crack down on the sales of sexually explicit items to teens.
I really appreciate you sharing that with me.
A relief to the parents we met.
They have adult stores for a reason, and they shouldn't just make it accessible to teenagers walking through a mall.
Ultimately, the state legislature will have to determine whether or not sexual devices are obscene. Spencer's also told me they carry the items in the back of the stores and have posted signs saying they carry adult content. As for the malls, all of the six in Oregon either declined to comment or referred me back to Spencer's. Jeff and Ann.
Thank you, Carla. Now, we checked, or Carla checked, and there are 14 Spencer's Gifts in Washington State. They also carry those sex toys and bondage gear. Also, if you have a story that you want our investigators to look into, call our tip line. Here it is, 503-464-0861, or you can send us an email. Just send it to reportit@coin.com.
Thank you, Christy. Okay, so, Mr. Chair and committee members, obviously what House Bill 3365 does, and there's a couple concerns that I know you may have. One deals with the constitutionality of it, and that's why Michael Slauson's here to address that issue. I think that we have addressed that with our concerns with Article 1, Section 8, especially under Section 1 with any picture, any book. And that's why all of a sudden you have line 17, which is under Section 1, Sub C, with the new addition to this. Because you have also now it describes what a definition of toys are and the instrument or device. Other than one primarily intended for a medical purpose, including contraception, that is specifically designed to sexually stimulate a person's genital or anal areas as part of an act of sexual conduct. And the second piece to this is what we were trying to pursue is the purchase of it. So it's making the material, the obscene material available, but then also dealing with at the same time the selling of it. The whole goal behind this is to protect children.
Hi, my name is Teresa Lee Ferguson. I live in Washington County over in Beaverton. In October of 2014, my 12-year-old daughter met with a few friends over at Washington Square Mall after school. She came home pretty jovial about something that she had purchased there. She laid it out for me to see, and she said, "Mom, it looks like a tobacco pipe, but it's a lollipop. It's candy." Upon examining the package, it was in fact called a lolly pipe, and it was a marijuana pipe made out of candy that tastes like a Granny Smith apple. Included in the package was a straw, and on the back was an image of two people that looked like they were snorting drugs. It said on the package, "Can be reused again and again, will not melt to flame." There was no age restriction on this package whatsoever. When I asked her about her experience at Spencer's, she told me that a 25 to 27-year-old man was working that evening and that he had offered to upsell her a keychain vibrator or body massager, as you might have it, ask her what colors she might want in said toy. It creeped her out. She said, "Mom, it made me very uncomfortable. I felt like he was a pedophile." I called Spencer's and I asked to speak to the manager on duty. He, in fact, was the man who sold this thing to my daughter. Ironically enough, she had also bought a pair of vampire teeth because Halloween was right around the corner. On the back of that package, it said 16 and up. But nowhere on the package with this marijuana pipe made out of candy was there an age restriction. I then asked her, "Can you tell me about a few more things that you may have seen in the store?" She said, "Mom, do you know those candy necklaces that we always get around Easter?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "They have those in panties and bras, and they're right near the body piercing jewelry." She'd originally gone in there with friends to buy a new nose ring for herself. And this is what she was subjected to. She then started to tell me about blow-up dolls, and she did not understand why there were tunnels sitting in the area that had lips on them. It's very uncomfortable to have to discuss something like that with your 12-year-old daughter, who should have never been exposed to that. Keep in mind, the Spencer's in Washington Square Mall is right at the top of the escalator going into the food court. Now, I'm sure all of you have children. And where do our kids like to hang out when they go to the mall? They go to the food court. They go and they hang out in these novelty shops. They're looking for different jewelry and different things that are in trend and different T-shirts and whatnot. I never would have expected to have that conversation with my daughter about what a ball gag should be used for. As I called the store to speak with the manager on duty, who was the gentleman, in fact, who sold this to my daughter, he told me they don't do age discrimination. I asked him, did he try to upsell her a keychain vibrator? He said she commented on one of the colors and thought it was pretty. So then he, I guess, decided to step in a predatory manner and offer it to her. I asked him at that point, I said, "So you mean to tell me if my 5-year-old daughter walked in there right now, that you would sell her one of these adult toys or one of these drug paraphernalia items?" He said, "Once again, ma'am, we don't discriminate against age." That's when I contacted my mother, who is here with me today. She went online, and she looked up the products online. Anyone can purchase these products online as well. No ID, no birth date required. She then got me in touch with Carla from Coin6, and that's when I met with her and had my interview with her. I'm very thankful that you guys are listening to what we have to say today as a concerned parent. I'm a single mother of two beautiful girls. Now I have a 13-year-old daughter and soon to have a 6-year-old the end of this month. I love them very dearly, and I will fight to the death to make sure that they are not exposed to things that they should not be exposed to. My daughter in particular was very uncomfortable with the situation because she was molested by a neighbor of ours at the age of 8 years old. So these type of things are very sensitive in nature to her. And I know she's not the only one out there. I'm sure there are plenty of other children that this would bring back horrible memories for, and plenty of children who might just take the chance to experiment with these type of things. I mean, there's enough youth prostitution out there as it is. Do we really want to be introducing our children to drugs and sex toys at this young of an age? Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice. My current assignment is a Special Counsel on Public Safety. The department is asked to review a House Bill 3365 and identify if there are any constitutional hurdles to its passage. Most specifically, we're looking at the free speech guarantees of both the federal and the state constitutions. I'm here to testify a little bit about that review. I think we most often think of Article 1, Section 8 of our Oregon Constitution as being more protective than the federal constitution in terms of free speech rights over the federal constitution. But the reality is that they're different. And so it's often kind of a challenge in Oregon to meet both standards in passing bills that can implicate speech. So I just want to start off with a caveat that when we think about the constitutionality of a statute, and when we're trying to pass specific legislation, we talk about mitigating the risk of a challenge or finding that it's unconstitutional, but it's very difficult to completely eliminate that risk altogether. I would say with that caveat, though, in reviewing House Bill 3365, this does not appear in any way to directly implicate speech. We don't see any direct Article 1, Section 8, or First Amendment problems with it, because it appears to regulate only the conduct involved and not actual speech. I would say that there are other things in here that help narrow the scope of the bill that would minimize if, any speech implications, if there were any. And I would point out those to be that when we're talking about what's regulated, and I should also have a caveat, I'm speaking specifically to the added language in A, C, and then B in the statute, and those are the particular provisions in which I'm talking about. You'll note in the language it's very specific as to what is prohibited. It talks about an instrument or device is specifically designed to sexually stimulate a person's genital or anal areas. It's not a device that could be used for that purpose. It's specifically designed. So that's significantly narrowing the scope of the statute. I'd also point out that there's a defenses in ORS 167085 that would also apply. And what's significant when we're talking about if there is any implication on speech in this is that it's a defense if this item is displayed or used in a school or a museum or a library or even a retail outlet that is serving one of those purposes, one of those educational type purposes. So it's the department's position that this bill is constitutional to the best we can say. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if the committee has any.
So I have to ask you, so one of them was like a personal massager. So that would not come under this, that they had on display. I mean, they had ones that looked like they had multiple heads or different choices.
Chair Barker, I would agree with that interpretation, that a massager that's not specifically designed for sexual stimulation of particular body parts. Yeah, your question also raises another thing. To the extent a court were to find that this were somehow, although not directly relating to speech, impacted speech in a way, the court can narrow the scope of the statute to bring it within constitutional parameters. So your question made me think of that. I wanted to add that too.
Thank you. I have a question for her.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think, Michael, I want to build on what the chair asked about. So if you go into a Walgreens and buy something called a personal massager, and the packaging, it's packaged with the language around it saying it's a personal massager. But you go into Spencer's and the same technology that may be a different color and packaged in a different way. How do you distinguish that intent without it implicating speech?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Initial part of your question is that the regulation of the Walmart purchase would regulate speech. That I'm not sure that it would, but accepting the premise, I think and maybe I'm not going to be answering your question directly as you'd like, but this is something that's specifically designed to sexually stimulate, so it would be different. It wouldn't be something that could be used. So, like, the Walmart purchase is something that could be used to serve the same purpose, but it would be different.
But it would only be different in the packaging around it.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson.
And the words used in the packaging. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I totally get where you're getting at. And I guess my response to that is I'm not certain that even the regulation of the product which you describe would still constitute a speech-related problem. So, for instance, in other words, the question presupposes that regulating the product at Walmart would implicate speech. I'm not sure that it would. So, in either case, it's not a speech-related regulation. So I don't see the implication for Article 1, Section 8, or the First Amendment in either context.
So maybe I'll ask it a different way, which is you don't know the purpose for the product unless you read the package. If they're the same, I'm presupposing right now it's the same piece of technology. One, the package says this is a personal massager.
Can I step in on this really quickly?
Let me just finish my scenario really quickly. And the other one says, this one's for medical use. This one's for sexual stimulation. But the product inside is the same. So my question is, how does the advertising of the purpose not implicate speech? Does that make sense? You've got
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williams, I totally understand your point, and I think it's a good one. It's to the extent that this arguably, if it could be read to be overly broad, if you think it regulates some sort of speech, I would point back again to the other aspects of the bill that narrowly tailor the scope of the bill. So what I understand your question is, hey, look, the only way I can tell whether something's designed to do it or not to do it is based on the packaging or maybe the intent of the manufacturer. And I understand your point. I think it's still narrow within constitutional parameters.
Okay.
Can I speak to this point as well? I think my main concern as a parent is that there's a huge difference between what you see in Spencer's and what you would see, say, at a Walgreens or a Rite Aid in terms of a personal massager. When it is shaped like a penis or it is a mouth with a tube on the end of it that vibrates, that is very clearly a sexual product that should not be displayed around children.
And I absolutely agree with you. I was just testing the constitutionality.
I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Thank you for hearing me.
For clarifying that. Representative Poston, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, maybe, I don't know if you could answer this or not, but my question, you didn't know it was coming. When you worked with the TV station, from what we saw that story and your testimony and a testimony of your person here, it seems to revolve around one company. Did they find it? Are there more than just all I'm hearing is Spencer's, and I don't want to necessarily pick on one company, but are there other companies doing this sort of thing in Oregon that you know of, or is this fairly common, or is it just this one organization or company?
Go ahead.
I have personally seen things of that nature in certain mini marts, but however, even in those. Living in Beaverton, we have a lot of mini marts and whatnot. Even in those, it's in a glass case that is not able to be seen by children. It's over to the side. There's a curtain there. You have to present ID to be able to look at those type of things. But for the most part, from my understanding as a consumer, Spencer seems to be the biggest company that does these type of things. I personally called Fantasy after my daughter said these things to me, and I asked them, do you think it would be acceptable for my 12-year-old daughter to be offered to buy a vibrator as an upsell? And they said that there's no way that they would ever allow a 12-year-old in their store. It's not like she looks like she's 18 by any means. You know, she's maybe 4'9" and 100 pounds tops on a good day. To answer your question, that is the only store that I know of that offers those type of things. There might be others, but just as a consumer, I can tell you that's the only one that I can really.
Yeah, quickly, Mr. Chair and Representative Post, when I was doing some homework on this, I actually visited an adult shop. First time I've ever been in one. And it was across from my old patrol office down there in Albany, which bothers me. But when I went in there, I had you should have on OLIS an email from the manager of that store and his wife, and they're concerned about this whole issue. During that conversation I had with the manager, he didn't just discuss that it was Spencer's stores, but he did identify some others as well. So that gets to your question.
So there are others.
Thank you. What is the law, the legal framework that typically governs where these kinds of stores can be cited? Because my impression is that these stores are often off on their own, you know, not as part of a mall. Is it a decision by the mall owner to choose to allow the store to be in the mall, or is it a local zoning rule that typically governs, or is it typically governed by state law? Do you know?
Chair Barker, Representative Landinger, actually it's State versus Tidyman that says that the government can't by ordinance regulate where certain businesses like that are located. So I'd imagine it probably would be the mall or some other private.
May I ask a
question? Sure, sure.
So I'm hearing you say that it's not clear that the reason those other businesses are segregated off from where young people are and where, you know, other shops are is a function of state legal decisions, but local governments have the power to make those decisions, and evidently they use that power as they see fit.
Chair Barker, Representative Landinger, I misspoke. In State versus Tidyman, or might have been Portland versus Tidyman. I'm so used to saying state because I think of criminal cases. It was actually, I think, a Portland ordinance that limited or directed where those types of businesses could be because they were singling out those types of businesses for the expressive content of those businesses, and the court found that to be unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair, let me say, I love this hearing. This is one of my all-time favorites. This hearing embodies everything I love about this committee, from courageous citizens coming up and petitioning their legislature, to Representative Olson doing investigations in the field, to Representative Williams, I thought, very astute point on constitutional law that I'd like to chat more about later. I think she does have a point about it infringing on speech. However, my understanding, and I do not purport to be a Article 1, Section 8 expert, is, you know, under Justice Lindy's framework, it's the historical exceptions recognized in 1859, I believe children were some of those exceptions and the presence of children. So even though it is implicates speech, I think it might withstand scrutiny even under Article 1, Section 8. It's my gut, but I defer to others.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton. So you're talking about the State versus Robertson framework, and so under the first, if it directly talks about speech in the statute, then yeah, it has to fall within a historical exception. A case that's sort of close to this, I would think of a State versus Stoneman that dealt with child pornography, and the court found that although it directly related related to speech, it would relate to the harmful effects. It was not overly broad. I understand Representative Williamson's point. I think they're well taken. I think, though, that the reason why our position is it regulates conduct and not speech directly, and it could be either a constitutional issue or a proof issue in terms of what does specifically designed mean. And so the proof in a particular case would be this, to show it's not the massager at Walmart or Walgreens, but it's actually specifically designed for the sexual stimulation. And so I'm not sure on the first one. I hear what you're saying. But I do think this is a content or a conduct-related statute, not a speech-related statute.
So I'm looking at 165.010, sub 1, sub A, any picture, photograph, or drawing, sculpture, or other visual representation of a person or the portion of a human body that depicts nudity, sexual conduct, sexual excitement, or sadomasochistic abuse. Why aren't penis-shaped things falling under this part of the obscenity law? It seems to me that some of what Spencer's is doing is covered.
Already.
Yeah. Because if your packaging mm-hmm. is obscene, or you have a sculpture of a part of the human body that fits within this definition, I guess I'm just struggling with the difference between creating, adding to the statute, and making sure we're enforcing what's already there. Because I would argue that some of what Spencer's doing is not legal.
And Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, I would agree with you. And so the caveat of part of my testimony today is that I'm focusing specifically on the additional provisions. But and I would say as to the other provisions, there are court decisions that found some of those to implicate speech and they're unenforceable. And so we're just looking narrowly. I would agree with you on its face that the what you've seen would also be covered under other provisions, but the court have found those unconstitutional. Is that, I don't know if that's response to your comment.
I don't know if it is either.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, maybe counsel can help me. I'm trying to figure out where the small A's and the small B's and the things go on the first 30 lines of page one of the bill. I'm trying to find out what the effect of these amendments are. In the existing statute, person can't allow children into a place where there are nude photographs and magazines and things like this. And this adds to that, if there are any of these sex instruments, it adds to the speechy kind of things, more physical things, I guess. Is that what it does? And then, before you answer, and then adds to the part above A, the knowingly let a child in, it adds to that allowing a child to purchase any of these. Apparently it's okay for a child to purchase obscene books and things in that shop. Is that right? Because it doesn't explicitly restrict that in lines in the sub A and sub B. There is not a sub C, as there is here, that says you can't purchase sex toys. I assume that means that it's okay for a minor to purchase other things? Or the reason I'm asking that question is if you can't let a minor in there, why do you add the fact that you can't sell something to them once they're in there? It seems to me being in there is enough.
Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, if you take a look at the very first portion of Section 1, Sub 1, a minor can go in there if they're accompanied.
Section 1?
Yeah, so it would be line 7.
We're talking about 167.080, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
They can go in there if a parent or a lawful guardian is there with the minor.
So they still can go in there if a parent or a guardian is there and there are sex objects displayed as well as dirty books.
That's correct.
All right, so we've added sex objects to the thing. So, if there's not a minor, I mean, if there's not a parent, a minor can't go in there, can't be in there, right?
That, the way I read, yes.
So now
it's just what we've done now is.
You can't be there, but in addition, I can't sell you something. Is that what we've done here? I mean, we've said a minor can't be in there where there's dirty books. They can't be in there with these dirty sex objects, which we've added to where they can't be. And then we add to that not only you can't be there, but you can't buy anything either, and that's another part of a crime when
okay.
I sell you something.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying, Representative Greenlick. What this bill does in sub one is removes displaying, makes it making obscene. It changes the whole game on this whole thing, and then also makes it available to
what
minors. That's huge.
Well, it says making available instead of displaying. Mm-hmm. Is that a material? I assume that's a council putting new words in. What difference between making available and displaying then? I mean, are we creating some new crime here, or are we just playing with words? That's
well, actually, it's an additional to a crime. Yeah, it's actually restructuring what the current law is and adding that, but restructuring it with a different terminology.
In other words, it's okay to have a kid in there and sell the kid the dirty books, but it's not okay to have the kid in there and sell him or her a sex object. Is that? I'm not a lawyer, so I only
trying
to common sense
well,
in the actual if, words.
Well, and Council and I were just...
Actually, if Legislative Council, if Jessica was here right now, she could maybe kind of help us out a little
stand
bit
stand at ease for
yes,
a yeah.
minute? Committee stand at ease.
Later.
Call the meeting back to order. We're going to suspend this hearing for a few minutes and go on to open a public hearing on House Bill
3249. Hi, is this Judge Pat Wolke?
It is.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Everything you're saying is everyone can hear you.
We're at the we're at the House Judiciary Committee. We just opened the hearing on House Bill 3249.
Sure. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3249 comes to this committee from Representative Wilson. It authorizes the civil commitment of a person who is noncompliant with assisted outpatient treatment, exhibits symptoms similar to those precipitating the assisted outpatient treatment, and unless treated, is at imminent risk of endangering themselves or others. We do not have any fiscal paperwork on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. Please go ahead and give us your testimony on this bill.
Thank you. My name is Pat Wolke, W-O-L-K-E. I'm a circuit court judge in Josephine County, have been since 2006. Chairman Barker and committee members, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me to testify by telephone. I believe it's probably been a long day for you, and I promise that my testimony will be 5 minutes or less, and when I'm all done, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. As it worked out, I'm on vacation, and so I don't have all my written material with me, but I think I know what I want to say. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the written testimony of Dr. Daniel Dick of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association, which is exactly on point. If I go too fast or if I miss something, if you can refer back to that testimony, his written testimony is excellent. If Dr. Dick happens to be present, I want to thank him and the OPPA for their excellent summary. Committee, I testified before this committee back in 2013 in favor of assisted outpatient treatment, which you passed out and it became law. It's now known as ORS 426.133. Oregon is one of 44 of the 50 states that have an assisted outpatient treatment law. Others that are more well known, there's Kendra's Law in New York, which is named after Kendra, who was a young woman who was pushed to her death before a subway train by an untreated mentally ill man, and Laura's Law in California, named after Laura Wilcox, who is a 19-year-old college intern at the Nevada County Mental Health Department who was shot by an untreated mentally ill person. And the purpose of this particular legislation, House Bill 3249, is to make AOT a efficient and more effective remedy. By way of background, I started the Josephine County Mental Health Court in February of 2009 and continue to preside over it. I have seen over the years how often a court order in combination with regular reappearances in court can be an effective to help people that are seriously mentally ill with their recovery. It doesn't always work, but it works many, many times. Besides Josephine County, there are mental health courts in probably about half the counties in Oregon, and they all do a very good job. AOT, or assisted outpatient treatment, is similar to a mental health court in that it is, it's a court order, just like mental health court is, and second, it involves periodic reappearances before a judge. And so there's the so-called black robe effect, where a person comes back into court and explains or discusses with the judge how they're doing within their treatment. Because of Oregon's lack of inpatient bed space, which is not just with Oregon but throughout the United States, we really need some alternative to help the vast majority of, or the vast population of people we have in our community that are untreated and seriously mentally ill. Two experiences I had convinced me that we need this additional legislation, which is kind of the final point of the AOT law. First, after the passage in 2013, the Judicial Department was nice enough to sponsor four webinars throughout the state that I either talked in or hosted, and they went out to Oregon judges, they went Oregon mental health professionals, trial court administrators, and so on. And several times after I spoke, the question came up from other judges or other people that with a lot of experience with mentally ill people, what happens if a person on an AOT order simply thumbs their nose at the order? And my first reaction was to say, well, that's contempt of court. And, you know, any court order that's violated can be contempt of court. And the problem with that, committee members, is that there are really only two remedies for contempt. One is to pay a fine, and the other is to go to jail. Both result in the criminalization of mental illness, which we're trying to get away from. And the second problem is that people that are seriously mentally ill oftentimes have tons of fines already that they have not paid, and going to jail for a mentally ill person, especially a psychotic mentally ill person, is about 10 times worse on that person as far as trauma as to remain in the community as compared with somebody that's not mentally ill. The second experience that I had is a real life experience in Josephine County. We had a young woman in Josephine County who was outstanding in every way. She was intelligent, she was well-spoken, attractive, etc. And at age 27, she had her first bipolar break, where she became very, very manic. And ultimately, there was a commitment hearing that was presided over not by me, but by another Josephine County judge. And that judge, after the hearing, decided that the woman did not qualify for inpatient civil commitment, which has a very high standard, as you probably know, but did qualify for the lesser criteria for assisted outpatient treatment. It's a lower criteria. The judge ordered assisted outpatient treatment, and that woman, for about two or three weeks, did really well. She started taking medicine for her bipolar condition. The mania started tempering. She resided at our crisis resolution center, and after about 3 weeks, she just decided, "I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't like the medicine. It's, you know, I don't want to live at the crisis resolution center." She just walked away. And for about 3 months thereafter, she was in free fall. She got worse and worse and worse, and she was engaging in very dangerous behaviors. She was sleeping outside. She was hanging around with bad people, engaging in very risky behaviors that really were life-threatening. And her parents were frantic. And ultimately, it became so bad that she did come back, and there was an inpatient civil commitment. The problem and the reason for this bill is we don't want to have that 3 months of free fall. We want to intercept the problem before it gets to that bad, bad stage. Finally, I want to address any concerns that either the committee members or other Oregonians might have about the legislation. I want to reassure people that it is not anything very new. There currently is in the law ORS 426.275. There is a procedure in place in our statute already for a person who is on inpatient civil commitment. The Oregon Health Authority lowers their level of commitment, for example, trial visit or a conditional release or something like that. They violate the terms of those lesser commitments, and they're brought back into court. It's kind of like a probation violation show cause hearing. And that is the
But we don't have that persistent outpatient treatment yet without this bill, and that's what this bill is designed to do. It's sort of like a show cause hearing in a probation violation. The person comes back into court. They are afforded all the procedural protections that they would otherwise have in a civil commitment hearing. In other words, they have a right to an attorney. They have a right to subpoena witnesses. They have a right to be heard. They have a hearing, just like in a civil commitment hearing. They have the right to an examination. There are the procedural safeguards in place for their being held pending the hearing. They can be released early if they don't qualify for this. And the burden of proof is by clear and convincing evidence. And in a normal civil proceeding, it's by preponderance of evidence, which is a 51% level of proof. Clear and convincing evidence is a higher burden of proof that the state must prove to show A, that they violated the AOT order, that their condition is at least as bad as when they got the AOT order, and third, and most importantly, that they're on a downward trajectory like this woman from Josephine County was, so that if she, to a reasonable medical probability, she will be eligible for civil commitment, in other words, danger to self or others, unable to provide for basic needs, as that has been interpreted by our Oregon Court of Appeals in the very near future. So, in summary, I think it's the final piece that would make assisted outpatient treatment an effective and efficient remedy in Oregon. And with that, I know it's been a long day. I will just say thank you again for allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have. I know that I'm going to be at the Capitol on April 16th with the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association to talk about this and other bills. And if I don't, I hope I might be able to see you then if I don't hear from you today. Are there any questions?
Anybody have any questions for the judge? Thank you very much, Judge, for your testimony. We'll
thank
let you.
You
hang up, and then we'll go ahead and finish up the hearing.
Thank you very much, Chair. Bye-bye.
All right. Maybe we'll go ahead and try to finish this one up quickly. Cheryl Ramirez, Dr. Daniel Dick, and Bob Jundep, please. And again, I certainly don't want to short anybody's time, but we're like, people will have to be leaving. We're at the end of our day, and we have to finish up the other bill, so I appreciate any if you could.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'm here on behalf of the Community Mental Health Program and Health and Human Service Directors that represent all 36 counties and Warm Springs Tribe. Although we understand the intent of this bill, we cannot support it. We oppose House Bill 3249. In general, we recommend a whole system review of the commitment statutes if there is widespread interest in changing the commitment process and criteria. We do not support any kind of piecemeal approach from the perspective of one or two system partners to change the commitment statute. And specifically, we're concerned that this bill is counter to the goals and directives of Oregon's agreement with the US DOJ to avoid an Olmstead lawsuit. Secondly, we believe that refusal of treatment and behavior due to substance use disorders does not qualify for civil commitment. And then third, and Judge Wolke mentioned this, the trial visit, which is similar to assisted outpatient treatment, is currently implemented in some counties. But to really do this systematically, comprehensively across the state, many must follow the person. So monitoring, supports, and services to help keep individuals in their communities are real costs. And this cannot, in effect, be mandated without funding. I've submitted a written testimony, which is far lengthier, but I'll stop now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. We do oppose the bill for two very separate reasons. One has to do with civil rights, and the other one has to do with the mental health system as a whole. I think there's efforts to put together a work group over the interim to look at the system as a whole that includes players from all sections of the system, criminal justice as well as mental health. We believe it's extremely important to have people who receive services in the system to be present in that process. And we think that that's one thing that's been strikingly absent in many of the bills that have come before various committees this year on civil commitment. Two very quick points. The first is that I worked with Representative Hicks on the very underlying legislation that this bill would seek to amend. I think one thing that's important to understand about that section is that while it allows a judge to order outpatient treatment for an individual, it specifically says that counties do not have to pay for that service. And so I think it's important to take a look at that statute, because right now it can put an individual in a position of being mandated to treatment that they cannot afford and the county does not have to pay for, and then potentially be penalized for not participating in the treatment that the judge has ordered. The last thing I would mention is that I just received an email today from the superintendent of the state hospital, who said that because the number of people who are being sent to the state hospital for restorative treatment because of a finding of being unable to aid and assist, that number of people has just had a record number of folks being admitted, 35, I think, in the last month. And the hospital is now opening beds in Junction City Hospital and in wards that traditionally serve forensic patients but now serve civil patients in order to be able to handle that overflow. And so our state hospital is really in a bed crisis, and sending more people to the state hospital would be ill-advised. So we really need to look at the system as a whole.
Thank you.
Dr. Thank you very much. I'm Dr. Daniel Dick from the Oregon Psychiatric Physician Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee for the chance to speak. I want to make it clear that I do work at the Oregon State Hospital, but I do not represent them in this talk. I appreciate my esteemed colleagues here in the mental health field working with patients. I think the number one deal for all of us is that we like to think that we're here to help our patients succeed in life and do the best that they can. The purpose of this bill, it is piecemeal, that is correct, and I agree that we need to have a full approach to the whole system in general. But the goal here is to actually help the assisted outpatient treatment have teeth, have some enforcement, and I don't mean enforcement in a law enforcement idea. I mean the idea that the judge can actually pass an action in the support of the patient receiving treatment. And I think I'd like to ask everyone to take a step back and look at this in the broad picture. A trial visit essentially is an assisted outpatient program after the fact a civil commitment has occurred. This bill would allow a judge to implement a pre-trial visit, a pre-civil commitment trial visit, if you will. I'm kind of mixing up a lot of words there, and I'm not trying to make it legal difficult to understand this. I just want to make the point that I think we can access the true nature of the assistant outpatient treatment program with this bill. I think funding is a serious issue, and that's something we should address in a real fashion. I will rely on my work to speak to you all at this point. I do work with civil commitment patients. I've been doing so since November of 2013. The number of patients that are recommitted who have gone all the way back to the point of complete deterioration that is understandable given their history of treatment is quite high, and I think this bill can help address it. It would only be a handful, because we have to speak about the patients that are already on assistant outpatient treatment orders. So we're not talking about changing the lives of hundreds of people, but we are talking about changing the lives of enough people that we can change the system in the counties where they are a problematic person in the setting of law enforcement, in the setting of emergency rooms, in the setting of community mental health programs. And this would allow us to help these people before they actually get to the point of known deterioration. Finally, I'd like to say that, again, I appreciate my colleagues' comments, and I think we are all here to help work together on this. Therefore, I'd like to promote this to a work session within your committee so we can continue to have the conversation, because I think even if this bill does not come to pass, it's opening up a conversation that needs to be had among all these different organizations. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to comment. I have two civil commitment bills and the health care committee that I'm struggling with at the same time. There's a fine balance in the civil commitment between what the patient believes they need and what other people, a judge, a parent, a friend, a relative, think they need. And we've been, that's a really fine balance to achieve, to try and find out how we deal with these patients. When they all get into this situation, there's a tragedy going on, and we know that. Now the question is, what's the right way to treat it? And we've heard over and over in testimony on civil commitment, this session, other sessions, that there are a lot of people who will be the objects of civil commitment who believe it's incarceration. They really don't believe it's in their own best interest. Now the question is, if they have mental illness, do they have a right to believe what they want to believe in their own best interest or not? And this is just one more example of this problem, and it's a very fine-tuned problem. It moves a little bit one way, a little bit the other way. I'm trying to figure out what to do in the next day with the two I have, and I think it's the same with this one. I think this is just a very difficult thing to do on a one-off basis, and I think that's what we're hearing from the witnesses, and we find some better. I hadn't heard there was going to be a work group, and I'm very happy to hear that. This is a very difficult issue, and it's very difficult to deal with one at a time.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Thank you very much for your testimony today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3249. Smack the phone. Reopen the hearing on House Bill 3365.
Okay, Chair Barker, when we left, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick had a question. I think he has a point. Under the way the law is currently written, and I see Ms. Menifee's coming up, there is a prohibition on these stores for allowing minors access to parts of the store where certain materials are available. I believe you're correct. This does add a new prohibition on stores, the selling of the materials. So I think this would apply to situations where a store did not display the items, but rather hid them behind the counter, so they weren't available for display. This bill would prohibit them from selling them without displaying them.
Well, it comes under the making available part of the statute.
I know Ms. Menifee's here to answer. she drafted that.
Chair Barker, Jessica Menifee from Legislative Council, and responding to you, Representative Greenlick. So there are two categories of things that are prohibited under this statute with this bill. One is the allowing the minor to enter or remain where certain items are displayed, and the other is allowing minors to purchase. The prohibiting minors from entering or remaining where something is displayed applies to Big A, Big B, and Big C. So it applies to the books, pictures, photographs, sculptures, and the instrument or device. But the purchase prohibition only applies to the devices. Because if you read in from subsection 1, it says a person commits the crime of if being the owner, operator, or manager of the business, they knowingly or recklessly permit a minor who is not accompanied by a parent or lawful guardian of the minor to purchase from the business any instrument or device.
So it is not a crime to sell, an additional crime to sell dirty books to the people that aren't allowed to be in there. Is that right?
Chair Barker, is that
what we assume from this?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, this particular bill does not criminalize that, and I don't believe there's anything on the books that specifically addresses that. There used to be a statute that was furnishing obscenity to a minor that was found unconstitutional, and that was eventually repealed, and I don't think it's been replaced by anything specifically since then.
So you can't furnish obscene material, but you can you can't create a crime for selling plastic penises.
Chair Barker,
obviously are not obscene under that definition, because you had to add to A and B to make it
Chair Barker, Representative Greenleg, I think sort of like a representation that is clearly a body part, so clearly a penis, then I think that would fall under Big A or Big B, because arguably it's a sculpture or other visual representation of a portion of the human body. I think what this bill...
Objects are already covered by A and B, huh?
The display of it would be. However, this bill does not prevent the actual purchase if that is all...
It doesn't say display anymore. It says making available now.
Right. Right.
So you just said it's displaying the problem, not making it available. I think this would argue making available is already covered.
Okay. So, sorry, Chair Barker, Representative Greenleg, I think maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying. So this is... I do understand where you're going here. So the making available change that I made in subsection 1 is just the name of the crime. That's not an actual element of the crime. I just changed the name of the crime to making obscene materials available instead of displaying, because the new language that I put in concerning purchasing didn't really make sense to me that it would be included in a crime called displaying obscene materials. So I just renamed the crime, making obscene materials available to minors. And you can see in section 2, I made that conforming amendment with the name change. But the actual elements of the crime are laid out of permitting a minor who is not accompanied by the parent or lawful guardian to, and again, enter or remain where there is displayed or purchase. So a graphically sculptural sex toy would be covered under Big A or Big B, or excuse me, Big A, because arguably, like I said before, that's a sculpture that is representing the human body. So that could not be visibly displayed in the store. If it also fell under Big C, or sorry, Little B, in that it was an instrument or device specifically designed to sexually stimulate, it also could not be purchased by the minor. But that would probably be a case-by-case basis where you'd have to look at the item. Was it clear packaging where you could see the item, therefore it was displayed to the minor, or was it in a box that just described what it was? And I think those were the kinds of things that someone would have to look at when they were trying to decide which subsection this falls under.
May I ask one more?
You certainly may.
Would it create two crimes then? Letting him there and then selling him something? Are those two separate crimes?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenleg, that's a good question. It's something that I hadn't really thought about until earlier in this committee hearing. I think it could potentially be charged as alternative theories of a crime, like it could appear on the same charging instrument. I guess the question would be, you know, is this sort of part of the same criminal episode? Could somebody receive two separate sentences? I think because it's under subsection A and subsection B, potentially it could be two separate crimes, like one would be visibly displaying and one would be purchasing. But I don't think for sure that someone could receive two, like, consecutive sentences for it, because I think that it's one criminal episode, somebody coming in, having these things on display and then allowing the minor to purchase it. So, again, to succinctly answer your question.
Not having it on display, that's a crime. It's letting a minor be there where they're on display.
Right. Well, letting the minor enter or remain where there is displayed. Right. So I think probably it could be charged as two separate crimes, but I don't think the person could receive, like, consecutive sentences just because of the fact that they're so closely related together.
So we might want to get this amended to include selling dirty books as a part of the second crime as well, since we think this is two crimes. Although apparently the Supreme Court won't allow us to do that. So therefore, you have to assume they probably won't allow us to prohibit selling sex toys.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenleg, if I could briefly talk about that.
Mr. Chair.
I don't know exactly what the Supreme Court would do if the actual purchasing of the pictures and books and whatnot were included here. I do know that previously the furnishing obscene materials was struck down because it didn't really fit within the defense that is described in 167.085. Because one statute used the term furnishing and the other was just showing, exhibiting, or displaying. And that was before the word furnishing was actually added to 167.085. So there was a whole lot of activity in that old statute, furnishing obscene material, that wasn't covered by the defense, and they said that that was overbroad. So potentially something could be written that would cover the books, photographs, et cetera. It's just not addressed in this bill right now.
And Representative Williamson, you think it's already covered? Did you? Or?
I think that some of the things that were on the channel six video would fall within current law.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Call Gail Meyer and Carolyn McCollum.
I don't have it done, so you wouldn't need a background check. Second law, because it's already against the law.
Short. Just stirring up this hearing. Just stirring it up.
I'll go first. Thank you. I'm actually going to be brief today. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We looked at this bill and we thought, whoa, what a constitutional quagmire. So we thought we would leave this for the trial practitioner if they should find themselves defending someone with respect to a crime charged in Section 1. There's a lot here. I do want to make a brief comment, and I apologize to Representative Olson that I didn't suggest this or approach him about this sooner. Section 2 has received very little to no attention, including myself, but this would allow this crime to have an extended statute of limitations. It would allow it to be for a minor until the any time before the victim attains 22 years of age. And so we would like to approach Representative Olson and suggest that this be confined to the more typical 3-year statute of limitations.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to just start by saying that I do understand, and we do as the ACLU understand, the intention behind this bill and the desire to protect children, and we very much appreciate that. What I'd like to do is give you a slightly different perspective on the constitutional issues than you've heard thus far. I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Slauson, but I would like to respectfully disagree about some of his analysis. As you all know, constitutional law has been litigated extensively, and our courts have set out standards which include elements that need to be in a law in order for a law to be facially constitutional. I'd like to say, though, that this legislature can, under current constitutional law, regulate obscenity to minors. That is absolutely something that you can do. But it can be sometimes difficult to write an obscenity statute so that it's not facially overbroad. And essentially, it requires that it includes certain elements that are present in constitutional law. And it is the lack of those elements in prior Oregon statutes, such as the furnishing statute, that caused that statute to be struck down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That statute was actually, it had more exemptions and more affirmative defenses than the one that is on the books now. So I'd actually like to suggest to you that the statute you're looking at right now is actually broader. And if it were challenged in a court of law, our position is that it would be facially unconstitutional. That could certainly be remedied by adding additional exemptions or affirmative defenses, but those are not present. So it would likely fail. The reason that the similar statute was struck down is because it included things like, for example, nudity. I can give you a really simple example here of something that would be unconstitutional under the current statute, a Greek sculpture for sale in a store. Under the plain meaning of this statute, that is criminal. there's no exemption that actually would limit that. When the court looked at the case, when the Ninth Circuit looked at the furnishing statute, it was actually a case that related to Powell's Bookstore. Powell's Bookstore brought that case, and they were very concerned that some of the things that they sold, for example, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, basic sex education materials, Judy Blume novels, that those things would actually fall under the furnishing statute. Those would also fall under this statute. So to get to some of the things that would need to be in the statute to actually make it constitutional, the really key thing is that the statute would actually have to have some sort of exemption for something that has serious value. It would need to consider the serious value of a visual or written work as a whole and whether it has redeeming social value. That needs to be in the test. There needs to be an exemption for that. The part of this statute that deals with selling the sex toys to kids, that part I don't actually take as much issue with. The part I take issue with, or we take issue, as the ACLU, is the part that deals with visually displaying sex toys. And I can give you a couple examples of things that would fall under this statute that we believe are not obscenity. The first would be a health clinic that displays sex toys for the purpose of educating young people about the dangers of sex toys. And I don't presume to know the committee's knowledge about sex toys, but there are actually sex toys out there that are very dangerous. There are sex toys that are made of toxic materials because they actually aren't regulated, which if you guys want to fix that, that would be great. There are sex toys that that if used improperly could really harm someone.
Probably a different committee.
Yeah, probably a different committee, but you can suggest it to your peers. Another example would be a visual artist, and granted, I know some wacky artists out there that you may or may not like their taste, but they could, for example, take one of these devices and incorporate it into a sculpture. If that sculpture was on display in an art gallery, because that art gallery is not a museum, that would actually be criminalized under the statute. Those are things that are just not, they're not obscenity. So what I would actually like to suggest to you is that this statute is fatally flawed from the start, and adding to it is sort of like building extra stories on top of a house that's already on a broken foundation. And if you wanted to do something, and with the Spencers thing, my actual feeling, and this is my presumption, but my feeling is that the reason that they're actually selling these things is because their lawyer has told them that our statute is fatally flawed, and the whole entire thing would be struck down. It's unenforceable. So if you actually want an enforceable obscenity statute, build in these exemptions that make it comport with constitutional law. Then you would actually have something that was enforceable, and you could potentially deal with a situation like Spencer's without reaching a bunch of other protected speech. And I'd be delighted to just be a resource for that if you guys want to have further discussion. So I just called you guys. I did that again. Sorry about that. Thank you.
Thank you. And when we were talking about this earlier, I was thinking of the common Statue of David that you see on low, just cheap imitations in all kinds of places. And I was thinking about that as well. So is there any questions?
Well, I have a question.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Kimberly, what's your thoughts about if we were to cause a referral to the voters to carve out a specific issue dealing with this in Article 1, Section 8?
If it was just dealing with the sale, I think
it would have to be a little bit bigger than that.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, just sort of off the top of my head, I don't want to necessarily analyze the constitutionality of exactly what it would need to look like. I certainly do think that prohibiting the sale of certain devices is much easier. It's much more easily constitutional because you can say that it's a public safety issue. You know, the device may be dangerous, so you can prohibit the sale. Prohibiting visual display of things is more complicated, and as I said, it would need to have all of those exemptions that are outlined in all the constitutional law on this. If it had all of those exemptions, absolutely, you can certainly criminalize obscenity to children.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. This happens every few years where some carve-out of Article 1, Section 8 is proposed. I don't recall it in the last few years, though. I remember we had one in 2009. It usually comes in the form of strip clubs. Like a strip club comes into a community, community gets outraged, becomes a political problem for a legislator, and the legislator introduces or proposes such a referral. And I'm happy to chat with you more. I just remember that it's a pretty big deal.
Well, I'm very familiar with it.
Yeah, you remember. All right.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kimberly, the affirmative defense is in 167085. How do they fit into your analysis?
Right. So let me just pull those. Oh, you've got them right here. So they're very minimal. They only specify, for example, a museum, a public library, or a bona fide school. That was why Powell's Books sued under the prior statute. It actually had the same exemptions there. So something like Powell's is not covered, or like I brought up, an art gallery is not covered. And again, this part where it's merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole, it's based on old constitutional law. That's not the current standard anymore. And that's it, right? There aren't any other exemptions. There's nothing considering the artistic, the literary, the social value. Which there needs to be some sort of consideration of that. And also there's the whole prurient interest. It has to appeal to the prurient interest. That can't just be regular old sexual interest. It has to be something that is heightened, something that people find very offensive, or based on our sort of social values. And certainly I'm not going to say that there aren't those types of things. I mean, and I haven't actually been to Spencer's for a long time, so I don't know. Since I was a kid, actually, but I don't know what's there or not. So I don't want to speak to whether or not those things fit that or not. But it's entirely possible that they do.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Vibrator and a keychain.
Any further? Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We did something that I said I wouldn't do, and that went past 5 o'clock.
Thank you.
Close the hearing. Thank you.